Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For virtual listeners, we hope your device stays locked onto website kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington so very special. Our Town profiles people from all walks of life, from firefighters to foodies, from bus drivers to baristas, and even the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. They say that the maritime industry accounts for over a third of all jobs around here. No one knows the exact number. Over the years that I've been doing the show, I've featured a number of people in different aspects of the maritime industry. Boat builders, port commissioners, even Daniel Evans, the race boss for the Race to Alaska. My guest today definitely has one of the more intriguing jobs in the maritime industry. Today's guest is Catherine Collins, Executive Director of the nonprofit foundation Sound Experience, which owns and operates the beautiful schooner, the Adventuress. So welcome to the show, Catherine. So glad you could join us.
Thank you, Marianne.
Okay, before we get to what you're doing with the Adventuress, I'd always like to give our listeners an insight into where people came from, how they got here. I really start at the beginning. Were you born and bred on the Olympic Peninsula?
No, I was not. I'm a transplant.
So here. Where do you come from?
South Shore of Boston.
That is a bit further east than Port Townsend. So did you go to school there in Boston, the Boston area?
Yeah. So I grew up on the South Shore of Boston, and I am a product of public school system.
Okay. And what your folks do?
My folks, just to finish the question, I did go out to University of Massachusetts for undergrad, but I did a graduate degree here in Seattle at Seattle University. So my dad was an early innovator in barcoding, and my mom worked at a radio station for the blind.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And are you an only child?
I am one of five, second to oldest. Nice big Catholic family.
Me too. Brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have an older brother, and I have three younger brothers, last I checked.
So you're the only girl.
I am the only girl.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So I always like to make a quick dip into people's high school years. Kids label each other. They say, you know, she's a nerd, she's a jock. But where do you think they labeled you?
I was a floater that went between all different kinds of groups, which is really interesting because I ended up doing a presentation applied. You had to write this to be able to do a speech at graduation. And I was not the smartest person in my class, so I didn't get valedictorian or anything. But I wrote a speech about being an individual in high school. I was able to, you know, do that at graduation. And I think what it really spoke to is I really liked seeing people for who they are as best you can in high school. And I just remember going between different groups and being really curious about people and groups. And of course, I wasn't cool. There was nothing about me that was cool. I've never been cool. So I had a lot of different friends from different backgrounds.
Were you one of those rare kids who really knew what they wanted to be when they so-called grew up?
Absolutely not. Okay. No idea. I knew what I loved. I was curious about a lot of stuff. I did a lot of stuff. And I tended to, as Joseph Campbell says, kind of follow your bliss.
So in your household, was it sort of expected that you'd go on to university?
Yeah. Okay. I was, yeah.
And you said you went to the University of Massachusetts.
I did, University of Massachusetts out in Amherst.
And so what did you major in?
I majored in communication studies, which is a little nebulous. But I think what I really majored in when I was there was different people I'd never met. And it was one thing to do the work. But I think what I became really fascinated with is different people, different cultures that I never came across on the South Shore of Boston. And so that, it was just an incredible experience. Kind of made me a liberal. my dad, who was at the time more conservative, was a little horrified that I went to University of Massachusetts, and he wanted me to go to Holy Cross, be a nice Catholic girl with a nice Catholic upbringing and education. But, you know, I think he ultimately, you know, was fine with that. But it did. I did go down a lot of rabbit holes out of curiosity.
And so when you graduated, what did you do at first? What were your first jobs doing?
Well, I followed in what, you know, you get internships. Oftentimes it's because of people you know, and that actually plays into what I do now. But you get internships, and so I'd gotten some computer-related internships, and I went into technology. I went into, believe it or not, my first job out of college was a company called Software House, which is ridiculous because that's the general name of every company back then. But it was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was an early database. And I spent a number of years in technology, but in my early 20s, I had kind of a major life shift that took me out of that and into nonprofits. I went to therapy for a year because I wasn't happy in a really good company, and decided that I was going to take what I knew how to do, which was kind of sales and outreach and community building and whatnot, and turn it into a career in nonprofit. That was a very long time ago.
Yeah. Well, sometimes therapy does seem to result in people making life changes.
Yeah.
Was the transition difficult? Did you take a break or anything?
Didn't take a break. It was really difficult in that I thought, who are you when you make a transition?
Right.
And I thought maybe people wouldn't, you know, talk to me, or like I back then, and it's true today too, is that if you're in technology, you really follow the trends and it's really cutting edge and you're always like have to stay on top of everything. I was like, I walked away from that. And that was a big deal because like I thought, well, would I have anything to talk to my family who were in technology or to others? And it turned out none of that mattered. It may not seem kind of like a courageous thing at the time, but I, you know, cut my salary in half and I went and worked for $14,000 a year in childcare resource and referral in Cambridge, and had no idea what I was going to do. And that's when I started fundraising, actually, and became mostly what I do is if you're in nonprofits for any length of time, you become a fundraiser.
Yeah,
I think
that's what they're all about.
So that's what I did. So I was making $14,000 a year in my early 20s.
So at some point you were with Outward Bound too.
I was. So that was a few years into my nonprofit career.
Right.
I worked at a computer museum after all the state money kind of got canceled for affordable childcare, which is still a problem today.
Yeah.
I went and worked at a computer museum in Boston, which was a really cool thing to do. There was lots of great, you know, like exploring the history of technology was really neat. And then I found Outward Bound. And I went to work for Thompson Island Outward Bound, which is an island in Boston Harbor that does work with urban kids and actually adults. And I got the opportunity to both fundraise from foundations and corporations. That was my actual job they paid me for. And then I got to become an Outward Bound instructor. So I was able to do both those things for several years. I worked out there and I lived in South Boston and took a ferry to Thompson Island. And it was the best job ever.
Yeah, that's
almost as good as this one.
Well, okay. So, you know, I've obviously heard of Outward Bound, but I've never experienced it. So what sort of trips did you do and what role did you play? Not on the fundraising side, on the hands-on side.
Well, I got to be an instructor.
Right.
Outward Bound programs went out of wherever there's bases all around the country, and I was in the maritime side of things. So I worked up in Outward Bound on Hurricane Island off the coast of Maine, and also worked, and these were in pulling boats, open boats. So they look a lot like the long boats with the Maritime Center. They're very similar. They were 14 to 21 days. I was an assistant instructor. I was not a licensed. You need a license in the boat and an assistance instructor. So I was an assistant. I was in my mid-20s at the time. And we were literally out at sea designing and working on programs for young people from all different backgrounds and also with adults. So I went out in some adult programs. And in the mornings, we would crawl out of our sleeping bags, which we'd been sleeping on the oars all night. You sleep kind of like sardines on the oars. They all get laid out every night. And then in the morning, you pretty much roll out of your sleeping bag into the water for the morning dip. And there were times when the water was 45 degrees.
Yeah, I was going to say, it might be a bit nippy there.
Yeah, in the springtime. And it was just what you did. You would, you know, pee off the back of the boat and in this little, you know, thing that they put together for, you know, doing what you had to do. You cooked in the boat. You did everything. And then we, of course, dropped teenagers off on an island by themselves to do their solo for a 3-day solo. So it was a,
as a group or as
no
a
individuals.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So some of these were inner city kids.
Yep, they were from all backgrounds, all walks of life. Some of my favorite ones were also of adults. Where we had, I remember this one time where there was a senior. And of course, I'm in my 20s, and I had a wonderful senior instructor with me at that time, who was an older fellow. And this one participant who was probably 70 maybe, it's hard to know. I was young, so people look different to me now.
Yeah, right.
Like I'm one of them now, right?
Right.
And so we had to do our morning dip, as you always did off the boat. And he jumped in the water. And what we noticed when he jumped in is he had one of those little capsules of, what is it? Where if you did have a heart attack, you'd take that real quick.
Oh, yeah.
What is that called? I don't remember.
Nitroglycerin?
Yes, that's what it is. Yeah. A little nitroglycerin capsule. And then he gets out of the water and he goes, well, that was my big test. And we all went, oh, my God, were you thinking you were going to have a heart attack? You jumped in the water.
Whoa.
So those were some of the great stories that came out of that. And some of the best people I've ever met in my entire life were those people. I will say that about Outward Bound, if you look at some of the leadership in this region, the Kelly Watson, the Jake Beatty, I'm trying to think who else came out of Outward Bound, Jesse Wiggles, who's over at, he's the new race boss, Daniel Evans, those are all Outward Bounders. Those are all people who cut their teeth on Outward Bound and worked in those programs.
Well,
and they are.
I've always wondered if you put someone out for 3 days solo, are there some people who can't handle it? What happens?
Well, we would go by every day in the motorboat and check on them.
Okay.
And we had a signal where they would wave, or there was a signal that said, I'm okay, or I'm not okay.
Okay.
So and I don't remember exactly what the signal was. It probably changed a little bit. But you would check to see that they're okay. And if they didn't come to the meeting point where they're supposed to show that they're okay, then you would go look for them.
Okay.
We never found anybody that wasn't okay. But I heard lots of stories where the kids would just leave or... I don't know. I mean, sometimes the solo was on an island where there were other kids, so sometimes the kids would get together, which defeated the purpose. But, you know, as an Outward Bound, you go through training where you do it yourself. So there's spring training that you get invited on as Outward Bound instructor, at least back then. And so we did all of those things ourselves, and so you really got to experience what a solo was. I'll never forget mine. We had an orange in the bottom of my bag, and I was like, I am not gonna eat that orange, and I didn't. We all had this sort of little competition. It's like, can we get through 3 days not eating, just drinking? We had to keep drinking, right?
Yeah.
And then and like come back with your orange that you hadn't eaten.
Wow that's
and
a test.
it was really something. And I really think Marianne, that's where some of the, you know, some of the tough comes from. You know, Outward Bound was started by Kurt Hahn, who noticed during World War II that the U-boats were taking ships out and, you know, the sailors would end up in the water and they had to survive this. And there was all kinds of obstacles to surviving those U-boat sinkings. And so what Kurt Hahn noticed, this experiential educator in England, was that the older guys were the ones that were surviving. It was the younger guys who were perishing. And it's because they didn't have that experience. And the truth is they're finding that out during COVID times as well. Older people who, of course, had more stability, you know, sometimes are struggling less or differently than younger people because they have that perspective of the lifetime of experience.
Interesting.
Right? So Outward Bound is based on that. And it still, to this day, remains one of my absolute favorite programs I've ever been a part of.
So why did you decide to leave Outward Bound?
That's a great question. Because I had an opportunity, knowing somebody in Outward Bound who pointed me to this opportunity, an older fella, that knew a program that did empowerment for women and girls who had been in abusive situations in a rural village in northern India. So I had an opportunity to go do that. And I was pretty good at saving money at the time, and you didn't need that much to go to India in the early 90s. And so I went and I spent 6 months in a rural village being a part of this program and supporting that. So I actually taught a couple of our Outward Bound initiatives. Like there's different things we do to bring teams together and such. I had to learn Hindi to do that with the girls. I also spent some time working on a Ford Foundation grant for them. So I was able to use some of my skills, but I learned far more than they got from me. I mean, let's be real. The experience I had, in a tiny rural village where, you know, I had, and this was way before any communications. There was no cell. I got maybe some letters, you know, but there was nothing else. And so that kind of experience was just, was really powerful and transformative.
How did you leave that?
Well, it was only supposed to be 6 months to a year.
Right.
And my brother was getting married, so I had to come back. Yeah, okay. I still to this day tell him, man, I would have stayed longer. But I think we had talked a little bit about some of the cool things that happened there, and that's actually why I'm in Seattle, is because I went to India.
Okay, so, explain that a little for our listeners.
So I took a break during my you know, and it was volunteer work up in Himachal Pradesh, and I took a break, and I opened up, this is for real, I opened up my Lonely Planet guide, and I put my finger in wherever it opened at. I like, this is totally random. I was just like, you know what? I'm going to go for a break, wherever it says to go.
Okay.
And I would take buses everywhere, and I'd dress in salwar kameez, and, you know, tried to blend as much as I could with red hair and
such. Red hair, freckles. So, I'm not so sure you blended that well, but
I didn't blend at all. No, let's be real about that. So it was Rishikesh where my finger landed. And I was like, Rishikesh. And I was like, well, that's interesting. That's where the Beatles went to find their guru. And so I got on some buses and I made my way over to Rishikesh. Along the Ganges there are these ashrams where people go study and do yoga and meditation and spiritual practices and such. Uh-huh. And so I literally went there. I had no plan. Right. Got off the bus. Started walking down through these different ashrams along, there's lots of them. And I walked into one called Vednaketan. And I met my future husband there. He was from Seattle. Super nice guy. He was climbing mountains and studying with Iyengar, the Iyengar who does the books of Iyengar yoga. And I just met him. I thought he was a really nice guy. You know, and nothing happened. We didn't get together or anything. Right. Yeah, I just remember thinking, what a nice guy. And then it's a good start. And then I decided I wanted to go look for yogis in caves and want to see, well, what are they doing there? What's that like? And he went climbing. So 3 years passes and we stayed in touch a little bit. And then we climbed Mount Rainier together and I fell in love. That's why I'm in Seattle.
Love conquers all.
It does.
Most things.
Something like
yeah,
that.
Right. Okay. So you came to Seattle and what then?
So that was 3 years later. So what then? I was working in 10 years for a microfinance organization. We were doing economic development in low-income areas of the United States, but it was with a large organization, a nonprofit that did economic development mostly in Latin America and in the United States. And so I worked for the U.S. side of things and helped put business students into urban communities where we would make affordable loans and support with grants some of the entrepreneurs, the people who had orange carts or who had new businesses or that couldn't get financing anywhere else. I was with that organization for 10 years. It's called Axion International. It's an amazing organization. It's people who know microfinance would know it sort of as the Grameen Bank of Latin America. And so Grameen Bank, a lot of people have heard about Muhammad Yunus, who started microfinance in Bangladesh. Well, this is the Latin American version of that. Okay. So I did that for 10 years. And then I brought that job with me to Seattle to be with Eric, my husband. And I really wanted... I was in nonprofits then for over 20 years, and I really wanted to be able to be a better nonprofit person and leadership. Right. And so I came to Seattle and did an MBA at night at Seattle University to be better at communicating with the private sector and better able to manage a nonprofit organization, which really is a business with a charitable ability to deliver services.
But how did you end up with the Adventurous?
Yeah, I know. It's sort of a long pathway, isn't
it?
Well, here's how it happened. I got out of grad school and I left Axion International. My job sort of wrapped up there after 10 years. And I was looking around and I was connected to Sound Experience, the nonprofit that runs Adventurous, because I had put a teenager who I ended up raising from age 14 on. I put a teenager on board Adventurous for a week, and I joined the board of this organization. And I'm trying to remember which came first, but I think Nah, I didn't know about this organization. I saw the ship sitting at Lake Union. I needed to find something for a very impulsive teenager at age 14 to go do in the summer months. I would send this young man to camps when he was a boy. It's a longer story, but how we got Freddie. Anyway, Freddie came to live with us. I put him on the schooner Adventurous, right. And he went to sea, you know, out Lake Union to sea, to the inland waterways for, you know, a week.
Right.
And I came back to pick him up. I had waited pretty much by the phone the whole time thinking that, you know, they were going to call like every other summer camp, so come you get got, your yeah, kid, you know, things aren't going well. Yeah. He just was very impulsive, amazing kid, super smart. And I came back and all the other parents are there picking up their kids. And he comes, he's not even there. So I'm looking, well, where did he go? What's going on? Turns out he's down in the engine room of Adventurous with the engineer, just totally immersed in doing whatever it needed at the time. And it was very cool. So I thought, well, this is great. He came home with us. All of a sudden he's doing dishes. He's seemingly kind of polite. He's like a happy
vast
kid.
Improvement.
Vast improvement. What they were able to do with the crew at that time, and that includes Gordon Sims, which is Buck O'Billy, who has been with the organization for years. He's also still a relief captain. He was the captain of that trip, and they knew how to engage him because you're needed on a vessel like that. That's how I got involved here. Yeah. I didn't become the director until... So after I joined the board, in fall 2005, I got a call from the board president, Jan Gray at the time, and she said, we've got a problem, and I'm on the board, but I wasn't the greatest board member. I wasn't paying that much attention, and I know, you know, board service is it's a really amazing thing when people can do that, but I had a lot going on. I had a teenager in the house and had a full-time job, and Jan Gray calls, and she said, the executive directors abruptly quit, and we're $125,000 in debt, and there's a hole in the boat. It's on the hard, and would you like to put an application in to consider being the director?
Okay, and you did it.
And I did it. So I went through the process, and
so most people around here know the Adventurous, but let's just give a couple of sentences of recap. When was it built? How long is it? What's the deal?
What's the deal? Well, Schooner Adventurous is an absolute jewel of Puget Sound.
Right.
She's become pretty extraordinarily special, even since the time I've been here. The ship was built in 1913 in East Booth Bay, Maine, for an Arctic expedition, really a hunting trip for some wealthy individuals named John Borden built the vessel. B.B. Crown and Shield of Boston designed the vessel. It also designed the Martha and also the Freya. I think it's the Freya is the name of Crown and Shield. There's three Crown and Shield vessels now, historic ships now in Port Townsend alone.
Well, it's
very cool.
Since you've taken over, millions have been spent to fix up the boat. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, and right now, well, first of all, I'm talking to you in the winter, so the boat is on the hard, as you say.
Yes.
And that's what happens. Your season starts in March.
March. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the Adventurous is dedicated. Its sole mission is really educational.
Mm-hmm.
And
that is true.
So when you rev up for the season here, what happens?
Well, so Adventurous is, I would say there's three, if you were to draw three circles and see where they meet, you'll put education, youth education in one of those circles. The second circle would be historic preservation, right. And the third is environment. And so she has always sort of played in that space. So that's what Adventurous does. Your question was about what happens when she gets underway. We do day and overnight education programs, some of which is aligned with public schools, some of it is aligned with community partners. And these can be 24 kids overnight on a multi-day voyage throughout the Salish Sea, or it can be a three-hour afternoon trip for a classroom from Chimicum or
so
somewhere.
So you have permanent crews, right?
We have a seasonal crew,
right,
who join us in March. Sometimes we have what they call two seasons, so spring, summer, and then summer, fall. But this year, we're going to have an eight-month season crew. And so we'll have 11 crew members plus captains living aboard the ship at all times.
And COVID did hit you guys pretty hard. You were shut down virtually everyone
like
else.
Like everybody else.
So does it look like the season, the 2023 season, is back to full steam?
Well, yeah, but things changed. Yeah. So there's no question it's different. I would say that we have a lot of work to do, but there's a lot of change underway. And the schools that, you know, they are still recovering. What's happening, you know, the challenges that they faced are way greater than any of ours. I mean, when I say ours, meaning mine. And that, you know, we have friends who are principals and things, and that the struggles that young people are having now are, you know, they're really serious. They need the kind of things that we're doing. They need to come together with their peers. They need to put down their cell phones. They need to feel like they belong and start to really, you know, explore who they are.
Deal with people again.
And yeah, we all do. I mean, let's face it, I'm still awkward. I mean, maybe I always was. I don't know.
Yeah, hard to say. Well, you know, we're virtually out of time here. And, you know, I guess in closing, how many individuals per year go through your various programs? I realize some are day trips, some are week trips, whatever. Yeah. But what are we talking, a couple hundred people?
Oh, no, more than that. Okay. So anywhere from, you know, 500 to 1,000 young people. And, you know, it has more to do. Some of them go, you know, go on for a week, you know, some are on for a day. And so we really are working on more of an in-depth experience as well. Okay. So whereas we might have served, you know, thousands at one point each year, now it's sort of more around 1,000 with a more in-depth experience.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if some of our listeners have family members or friends that they think this sort of thing could benefit, what do they do?
Sure. Well, feel free to contact me directly, Catherine@sounddxp.org, or give me a call. I'm 206-353-6119. You can also call the office at 360-379-0438. Extension 1 will get you Susan. And also, I'd love to, you know, since you're local and folks in Port Townsend, if they want to come down and get to know the vessel, the best way to do is come, you know, pick up a paintbrush and do a volunteer work weekend with us. Or we're even looking for people during the week to come help out with. We have 4 crew members on board with our captains right now who are getting the vessel ready for the season. So February 18th and 19th is our next volunteer work weekend, or you can even come down during the week and help out for a couple hours.
So people can volunteer, and suppose if they contact you or go online, they can figure out where the boat is.
They sure can.
Get down there and help out.
Exactly. No, and this is a vessel that belongs to the people of the Salish Sea. It really is an amazing ship to be able to help restore and fully restored, you know, 10 years later, and we're putting the topmast on. So that's the exciting winter project.
Years ago, it got removed due to jobs.
As we put on a new deck, we took them off, and now we're getting back on again. So there's a whole community behind that, especially Haven Boat Works, which is doing the construction as a gift to Sound Experience. It's amazing.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ, Port Townsend. My guest today has been Catherine Collins, who is the executive director of Sound Experience, which is the owner and operator of the great ship, the Adventurous. This show is called Our Town. I'm Mary Ann McNellis. I'm signing off for today, but please stay tuned to KPTZ for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production, created by Mary Ann McNellis and edited by Taylor Clark.